saving money on everything now at Menards. Create fresher, cleaner air with damp-rid products. Control the humidity in your space with a hanging bag moisture absorber. They're great for closets and laundry rooms. Grab a 3-pack on sale through September 8th. Save big on damp-rid moisture absorbers at Menards. America's number one home improvement retailer for customer satisfaction according to J.D. Power. Visit jdpower.com for details and menards.com for deals. Save big.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
Chapter 8 of Tom Clark and His Wife, The Rosicrucian Story, by P.B. Randolph. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Betsy Clark in Dreamland, Part 1. Could I withink the ocean fill, were all the earth of parchment made, where every blade of grass a quill, and every man a scribe by trade, to tell the love of God above, would drain the briny oceans dry, nor would scroll contain the whole, though covering all the arching sky. I believe, just as did the writer of these lines, said the Rosicrucian, as he began his recital in the cabin of the Uncle Sam, after partaking of what the purveyors of that steamship line, in the rich exuberance of their facetious imaginations, were pleased to call a supper. Betsy Clark was dreaming. It was morning, and the glorious face of the sun shone in unclouded splendor over the world, this world, which, to the good man and woman, is ever a world of good and beauty, viewed from the God's side, whatever it may be from the human. All things were praising him, at least all dumb things were, for men so intently adore their lares and penates, dollars and dimes, that they have scarcely time to devote a worshipful thought to him who is King of Kings and regnant God of Gods. Nature was arrayed in gala robes. She had put aside her frowns, and now smiled sweetly on the world, decked gaily in pearls and light. She was on her way to attend the weddings of the flowers and the birds. Betsy Clark was a blithe young girl again. In her dream she was gaily tripping o'er the lea, her happy heart swelling and palpitating with strange emotions. She was a budding virgin now, and her heart flowed with innocence and love, accompanied with that pure but strange wild discontent, and longing for she knew not what, but something, which all young women feel and are conscious of as they pass the golden barrier that divides their youth from womanhood. It is, and was, the holy and chaste desire to love, and be loved in return, from the heart, sir, right straight from the heart. Ah, how I sometimes wish I had been created a girl instead of a boy. Bah, what's the use of wishing, especially when all the girls desire an opposite transmigration? Betsy's bloom outrivaled the blushes of the newly wedded roses. Roses just married to sunlight, in the morning dew, with all the trees for witnesses, and all the birds to swell the sounding chorus. And she was happy. Ah, how full of happiness! And yet it was slightly dashed with bitterness, just a taste of gall in her cup of honey, for she imagined a more perfect state, had vague dreams of something still higher. So have we all. We have it, and that is a certain sign that that higher something is attainable, if we only try. Someone said he wanted to eat his friend. Good, but I want to lose myself in another self, to make them twain a unit, which is better, or to thus blend, and then lose ourself in the great God life, which is best. And she gaily tripped over the lea. She was going with a pitcher of cream and a basket of fresh eggs toward a hole in the rock, not a great way off, to present them to the strange hermit of the silver girdle, who dwelt within a little grotto just upon the edge of a forest wild, hard by her girlhood's home. Now, be it henceforth known to everybody, and to everybody's son and daughter, if the fact is not already patent unto them, that every female between the ages of 15 and 23 is naturally, spontaneously, and inevitably in love, and all that is then wanting is a suitable and worthy object to lavish it upon. If she finds such, well and good, but whether she does or not, still she must, and will pour it out, either healthily or otherwise, on a cat or a man, a poodle or politics, marriage or a mirror. Between those ages the female heart is just as full of love as an egg is full of meat. Nor can she help it. It is the birth of affection, love, romance, the endeared and the endearing springtide of life and emotion. Alas, that the tide too often ebbs, never, never to rise again this side of the grave. Then in the rich exuberance of her innocence and purity, woman, unlike man at the same age, thinks no wrong, fears no harm. Gentle, trustful, noble girl! Blessed is he who then calls her to himself, who in the morning of his life and her own shall win and worthily wear her heart. And abased indeed is he who then shall gaze upon her with unhallowed eyes, and seek to lower her from the path of honorable womanhood. Presently the girl reached the hermit's abode, saluted the reverend man, presented her welcome gift, and received on bended knee his blessing in return. They conversed a while, did that fair girl and that strange recluse. The hermit stood on this side, the maiden stood on that. "Daughter," said he, as he placed his white palms upon her beaming forehead, "the world and all it contains amounts to but little, if it, and they be, not improved to the utmost. The attainment of the soul's aliment, knowledge, which it assimilates and digests into wisdom. I have partaken of that food for 80 years, have converted it into wisdom, and expect to be thus engaged during long centuries to come. Thou seest me living here alone, dependent upon the charities of such as thou. Poor in California, where even the rocks are retained by golden wedges in their places, and where diamonds sparkle in 100 valleys. Thou seest me shut out from the busy world, and drawing life from charity and heaven. Such an existence is suitable for me, but not for such as thee. I am a student and professor of a strange and mighty magic, for I possess the marvelous mirror, and the still more wondrous crystal globe, both of which are heirlooms of the early foretime, handed down the ages to me, as I in turn shall bequeath them to the ages yet to be. But thou art a woman, and cannot afford to shut thyself out from life, society, and pleasure, as Rosicrucians do, and must, if they would obtain the kingdom, the password, that uplifts the sable curtains that hide 12 worlds, and the key by which the doors of mystery are opened. Child, for thee there are more fitting things in store than the upper knowing, better than solitude, higher charms than study, and abstruse pondering over recondite lore, and subtle laws of being and of power. Thou in thy way, I in mine, are and must be soldiers in the strife for holy peace, toilers for the millions yet unborn, mechanics for redemption of the world, active bees in the busy hive, thou of active human life, I that of human destiny, together marchers in the grand army whose movement is ever onward, and which never looks behind. I strive for the true. Thy destiny tends toward the beautiful. Together we shall reach the goal of good, moving over thorny roads, albeit on the way, for there are many dangerous pitfalls, deep morasses, dismal swamps, gloomy forest solitudes, and stony mountains, steep and slippery, that bar man's path to happiness. Prepare ye the way, make his path straight. Such is thy business, and mine. To accomplish this duty I am here, but a different field is thine to labor in. To achieve thy destiny, thou must place thine affections upon a son of man, thy soul's great love on God alone. You must wed, bear children in great agony, yet gloriously, to your husband, your country, and to him. I will now, by means of the higher magic, which I am able to use in thy behalf, show the figure of a man whom you will hereafter marry. You shall behold him as he is, as he will be, and as he may become, provided you choose to make him so. For a husband is ever and always just what a woman makes him. I am now about to display a phantorama of the future before you. Observe and note well all thou mayest behold. Speak not thereof to vain worldlings, who cannot comprehend deep mysteries such as these. Above all, utter not one single word while thou sittest at yonder table, gazing into the future revealing crystal globe. And so saying, the gray-clad hermit of the silver girdle, who dwelt in a forest wild, led the way to a recess of the grotto, where the light was very subdued, very dim, and exceedingly religious. There he seated her before a tripod, supporting a triangular shelf or table, himself taking a seat directly opposite. Upon this table he then placed a small, square, dark leathern box, opening on brass hinges across the sides and top. He opened it, while reiterating his caution, and disclosed to the enraptured gaze of the doubly delighted girl. All girls are delighted before they get their husbands, and many of them are considerably delighted, if not more so, to get rid of them afterwards. A magnificent globe of pure crystal, clear as a dewdrop, radiant as a sunbeam. It was not over 4 inches in diameter, was a perfect sphere, and was altogether beautiful, in this respect, infinitely transcending that of soap bubble of the same size. A humble comparison, but a just one, for there are few things more beautiful than these self-same soap bubbles. The first impulse of the girl was to handle this beautiful trinu, as it was called, and she made a movement with that intent, but was instantly prevented by the hermit in gray, who said, "Not for 100 husbands should mortal fingers touch that sphere, for such contact would instantly rob it of its virtues, perhaps never to be regained. Look, my daughter, look, but touch not." She obeyed and withdrew her hand, but reluctantly, for her fingers itched severely, as what young woman's would not under similar circumstances. Vide the apple and Eve, by means of which man fell, but fell uphill nevertheless. A great trait is this curiosity. It is a woman's nature. It is her great prerogative. Eve looked into matters and things generally, induced Adam to follow her example, and thus was the main lever that lifted the race out of barbarism and into civilization and decency. So much for this much-abused female curiosity. But for it, man had remained a brute. With it he has risen to a position a long way below the angels, to be sure, but then he is coming up. The twain now began to gaze steadily at the magic globe, maintaining perfect silence for the space of 10 minutes. All was still, hushed, silent as the grave, and only the wild throbbings of the young girl's heart could be heard. Presently the crystal began to change, and to emit faint streams of pale light, which gradually became more pronounced and distinct, until finally there was a most magnificent play of colors all over its surface. Presently the rich, effulgent scintillas, the concentric iridescent flashings previously observed, ceased entirely, and in their stead the girl began to notice 2 very strange and extraordinary appearances, which to her and to all save those who are familiar with such mysteries, and which, although nearly unknown in this country, are still quite common in the farther East, are totally unaccountable. In the first place, she became conscious that she was breathing an atmosphere highly charged with a subtle aura that manifestly emanated from the body of the crystal itself. The air was entirely different from that which floated in the grotto an hour before, when she entered with her offering, because it was unmistakably charged, and that, too, very heavily, with a powerful magnetic aura. I said magnetic. I should have said magnetoid, for whereas the former induces drowsy feeling and somnolence, the latter had a purely opposite effect, for it provoked wakefulness, and promoted greater and intensified vigilance on the part of both the woman and the man. In the second place, there came a remarkable change in the crystal itself, for having lost its brilliant diamond-like colors and interchanging rainbow spray, it now became decidedly opalescent, speedily passing into the similitude of a ball of clear glass, with a disk of pearly opal transversely through its center. Very soon even this changed, until it became like a dead white wall, upon the surface of which the eye rested, without the power of penetration as before. Gazing steadily upon this opaque frame, the girl in a short time distinctly and perfectly beheld, slowly moving across that pearly shield, as if instinct with life, numerous petite but unmistakable human figures. Figures of men and women, tiny to the last degree, but absolutely perfect in outline and movement. And they moved hither and thither across the field of vision. She saw them moving through the streets of a city. A little closer. As I live, they are going up and down Bush Street, an aristocratic thoroughfare in the great city known in this story as Santa Blarneo. This fact she instantly recognized, with that strange and inexplicable anachronism peculiar to dreams, and the still stranger inconsistency peculiar to dreamers and voyagers to the Summerland. Gradually these tiny figures appeared to enlarge, or rather she saw them in such a perspective that they looked like full-sized persons some little distance off. Even while she gazed, the crystal changed again, or rather vanished from her perceptions altogether. The figures enlarged, approached as it were, and she became a passive spectator of a scene at that moment transpiring. But where? Certainly not in this world of ours, nor in dreamland, nor in fancy's realms, nor in the home of souls you read about in the very funny descriptions of Starnos and Kor, nor in Guptarian, nor around the lakes of Monia, nor among the Pyramidalia, nor in Saturn, nor in any of the gloriously ridiculous localities imagined by A.J. Davis, and put forth by him in the delusive hope that any sane man or woman could be found green or fool enough to swallow. Few men better deserve the name of impostor than the author of Guptarian, Mornia, Foley, Starnos, Galen, Magic Staffs, Harm Only, Man, and Kor, not one of which has the least existence on earth, under, or above, or around it, but the true and exact location of which is on an extensive and very soft spot just above their author's ears, and the soft spots of his followers, for it is morally certain that no one with even an ordinary modicum of, not sanity, but common sense, can, would, or could accept his funny philosophy as true. Where, then, was the true locality of the scene that Betsy saw taking place, you ask? And I answer, and I tell you in nearly the words of the strange hermit of the Silver Girdle, when explaining it to Betsy Clark. All these strange things are occurring, not in any sort of phantom world, but in another material earth, quite as solid as this. This crystal is a magic telescope through which we may view whatever we desire to, whether on this earth or off it. Listen, space is by no means limitless, but it is a globular or elliptical definite region, the playground of the powers, and is bounded on all sides by a thick amorphous wall, of the materials of which new worlds and starry systems from time to time are fashioned. This wall is thicker, a million-fold, than the diameter of the entire menstruum wherein this universe is floating. Surrounding this universe, on all sides of this wall, are seven other universes, separated as is this, from all the others, and they all differ from our own and the rest, as differs a volcano from a sprig of rosemary. That is to say, utterly, totally. The material worlds of each of these other universes outnumber the sands of the desert, yet their number is precisely that of one in which we live. But they are larger, for the earth that corresponds to, and bears the name of this of ours, is, in the smallest of the other universes, quite as bulky as the sun which gives us light, and the other solar bodies in proportion. The universe next higher is immeasurably larger than the one just alluded to. It has the same number of material worlds, and the earth corresponding to this of ours is as large as the solar system in which we are. That of the third is as large as the solar system of the second, and so on to the last of the series of seven. But not the last, in fact, for outside of and surrounding the entire seven is another wall, separating them from 49 other systems, in ascending grade. I cannot now give you any information respecting the sublime realities of these 49, nor of the regions and realms still beyond. Therefore I recall your attention to this world and sphere of being. On earth there are seven distinct classes or orders of men: the instinctual, affectional, intellectual, intuitional, aspiring, indifferent, and wise, to all of whom a different destiny is decreed. Organizations determine destinies. Every nebulae seen in the far-off heaven is a system of worlds. That wonderful family of stars to which our sun belongs is, with all its overflowing measure of stardust, but a single cosmos. And there are myriads of such within the confines of this present universe, and before we cross the vast ocean of Ethel and reach the wall alluded to. All things are in halves: male, female, negative, positive, light, dark, and so on. So is the nebulae of worlds to which we belong. Now, remember what I have said of the resemblances between this earth and universe and the seven others beyond the wall. Precisely such likenesses exist between the worlds of the respective halves of our own system. At various distances, flecking the vault, we behold suns and systems innumerable. These all belong to this, the female half of our system. Beyond them lies a vast ocean of ether, separating the continents. Across that ocean, a distance incomputable by the human intellect, is the male half of our system. There is a sun precisely as large, as brilliant, and as hot as ours, and no more so. Around that sun fiery comets whirl, planets revolve, and meteors flash, just as they do hitherward. There is a Venus, Mercury, asteroids, Mars, Jupiter, and all the other planetary bodies, just as here, and of the same dimensions. A globe there is called Earth. It has a moon, an Atlantic, Pacific, Mediterranean, and other seas, exactly equivalent to ours. It has a California, a San Francisco, Paris, Berlin, Munich, Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Pittsburgh, just as here, and their names as are those of its trees, countries, counties, town, people, capitals, are exactly as on this earth. There is a President Lincoln and General Fremont, a Thurlow Weed and Colin Bryant. Anagazi's and Horace Greeley, Atlantic Monthly and Harper's Magazine, a New York Mercury, an Independent edited by Beecher, Tilton and Levitt, and they deal the same as do their similitudes here. The streets and omnibuses are precisely as here. Wall Street is as full of thieves, and contractors get fat off their country's gore as they do here. There is a rebellion there, and Union generals sell themselves to treason just as here, while the men who could and would save the nation are left out in the cold, in spite of the Tribunes, Posts, and Times, all of which long since pointed out the road to Richmond and to victory, and were laughed at just as in our planet. In that far distant world there is at this moment a steamer, Uncle Sam, sailing across the Gulf of California, as at this moment we are, and on board of her there are just as many men and women as on this one, and their persons, names, habits, features, motives, hopes, fears, characters, secrets, and intellectual and moral natures are precisely the same as our own on board this ship. Our namesakes there are at this instant doing, thinking, acting, reading as we are, and some of them are listening to a very strange story, and its still stranger episodes, told by a Rosicrucian, just such a personage as myself, indeed my very self, in the self-same form and feature. And I say, and I tell you, that the alter ego, the living portrait of each man and woman in this circle, is thinking of him or herself, and of me and my revelations, at this moment, with the same stupid levity, with the same deep and awful impression of their truth, in the same manner, whatever it be, as are all of you at this moment. And some there, as here, set me and my story anaught, stigmatize me as an enthusiast or dreaming poet, as do some of you. Others believe my truths. You have heard that coming events cast their shadows before them, and that prophecy has been demonstrated true. Behold the solution of the world enigma. Events transpire in that other world a trifle sooner than they do here, yet you must remember that there is a vast interval of space, and therefore time, that must be bridged by even that swift courier, sympathy. According as a man there, and his counterpart here, are fine, aspiring, and spiritual-minded, so is their rapport across the awful gulf. And the male half, the more perfect portion of each man or woman's self, very frequently telegraphs the other, often a long time before the event becomes actualized on this earth. You have heard of fays and fairies. Listen and learn the truth concerning them, remembering that no human soul can by any possibility quit the confines of this universe until it has exhausted the whole of its, the universe's, resources, and has attained all of love, will, majesty, power, wisdom, and dignity that this vast cosmos can give it, after which it sleeps a while, but will awaken again to the exercise of creative energy on the thither side of the wall. Both duplicates sleep at once, for, after their deaths on the material earths, they exist apart, but sustain the same relations, in certain aromal worlds attached to their respective primary homes. At the final deaths, they blend forever, their stature is increased, and they enter, through the wall, that earth resembling the one whereon the double unit had its birth originally. You have heard of metempsychosis, transmigration, of reincarnation, and of progress. Listen and learn more. Not only the inhabitants of countless myriads of worlds in this material and aromal universe, but also the material and aromal worlds themselves, are in a constant state of progressive movement. By aromal worlds I mean the aerial globes that attend each planet. They are places where souls rest a while after death, before they commenced in earnest the second stage of their career, and this state is an intermediate one, just like sleep, only that they are conscious and active while there. But it is an activity and consciousness, not like, but analogous to that of a dream. Every world and assemblage of worlds is periodically reduced by exhaustion, but at enormously long intervals, into chaos, and is then transformed or created anew, still, however, being the same world. After this passage, each system and world becomes vastly more perfect than before, but owing to the diminished quantity of spirit or essence which has been consumed in giving birth to hosts of immortal armies, each system and world is vastly smaller than before. This is for two reasons, one of which I have just stated. The other is in order to make room for new cosmi and new worlds, both of which are being constantly created from the material of the wall, and the wall itself is the condensed effluence of the Maker. In short, it is God-odd, and therefore inexhaustible. The majority of those who have lived on any world are reborn in it after its restitution, they, in the meantime, having grown correspondingly clean and perfect. The same relative proportions between a world and its occupants is still preserved, and never varies. And, consequently, the 6-foot man and the 5-foot woman of one career find themselves in their next state, occupying 5- and 4-foot bodies respectively. The present is our 34th incarnation. Originally we were taller than many of our present trees, and coarser than our mountains. We are smaller and better than ever before, and our worst man is better than the best of the preceding state. The worst, in the next change, will be better than our best. To illustrate, let me say that the following persons, viz. Thurlow W., Abraham L., Russell L., J. Gordon B., Henry J. R., William Collin B., Jefferson D., John G. Free, James Book, Wigfall, Charles Sum, Horace G., Fernando W., George B. Mc, Jan J. H. K. R., Dr. H. F. G. D. R., Charles T. N. S., Lizzie D., and myself, respectively, were previously to the last change. The first a feudal lord, the second an editor, the third a Danish prince, the fourth a court jester, the fifth a missionary, the sixth a generalissimo, the seventh a harpist, the eighth a theatrical manager, the ninth a knife grinder, the tenth a privateer, the 11th a preacher, the 12th a schoolmaster, the 13th a trumpeter, the 14th a politician, the 15th a hunter, the 16th a very little boy, died exceedingly young, the 17th an emperor, the 18th born a queen, and the last a barber's clerk. So that it is evident that though our progress is slow, still that we are coming up. Little as our actual worth may be, still we are better now, generally speaking, than in the former stage. Thus, we will grow smaller at every change. Some worlds and their dwellers in this universe have thus decreased, and being sometimes seen by people here, have been called fays or fairies. The world has yet to undergo some thousands of these changes, until at last we become very small indeed, which will occur when conception is no longer possible in the universe, either in the vegetable or animal worlds, and then will occur the change and transference beyond the wall. Betsy Clark was beholding persons and events of that other world half of this, our little staying house, beholding things through that fairy lens, that beautiful magic crystal through which the human eye can see, the human brain sense, things that have occurred, are occurring, or are to occur, upon the world stage of this our life's theater. It is an established fact that fools never dream. Wise people often do, and those belonging to the latter category cannot have failed to notice that things, dates, persons, circumstances, and probabilities are considerably mixed up as a general thing in dreams. Their anachronisms are especially remarkable and provoking, and indicate that time is of but little, if any, account, so far as the soul, per se, is concerned. A dream of a minute often embraces the multifarious experience of a century. This instant you are hobnobbing with one of the pre-Adamite kings on the plateaus of Eastern Asia, and in the next are taking wine with the Pharaoh and Moses on the banks of the Nile. Now you are delivering an oration before Alexander the Great, and in a jiffy find yourself stuffing ballots on Cornhill in an election for ward constable. Now you are contemporary with Sardanapalus or Thothmes III, and in half a second you are delivering a spiritual lecture in Lamartine Hall, having paid 50 cents for the privilege of listening to your own splendid and overpowering eloquence. Taken together, dreams, like complementary benefits, are queer concerns. Such was that of Betsy Clark, for at one moment of time she was a virgin girl, a wife, a widow, and a wife again. She recognized at once the facts of her girlhood, that she had carefully deposited one husband in a hole in the ground, and was in high hopes of performing the same kind office for a second, Mr. Thomas W. Presently the view in the crystal faded away, and in its stead there came the appearance of a large and splendid atelier, containing numberless statues, in a more or less finished condition, standing on pedestals or in niches round the wall sides. The sculptor was absent. It was evident at a glance that his images were not hewn of marble, but of some other material, which needed but a touch of fire to make them start up into life, liberty, and light. It was a man-factory, a place where people were carved out to order by a wonderful artist, who had just opened business thereabouts, and who, judging from appearances, was already in a fair line of patronage, and quite likely to do well, if not better. Standing near the center of the apartment, propped up with bits of wood, Betsy saw the exact likeness, in all respects, of Mr. Clark, but the figure was unfinished, soft, puttyish, and doughy as a northern politician. The statue stood semi-erect, and strongly suggested an invalid kitten leaning on a hot brick, or a modern philosopher of the spread-eagle and progressive school, when the contributions are small. The figure was labeled Tom Clark, as he was, that is to say, soft, ductile, capable of being molded into the ruffian or the man. Directly beside it was another statue, closely resembling the other in many points, but yet different. It was labeled Tom Clark, as he is. That is to say, it looked as if abundantly capable of feeding on tenpenny nails, dining on files, and supping upon pigs of iron. It looked, for all the world, as if the greatest possible favor that could be done for it would be to tread on the tail of its coat, or knock a chip off its shoulder, or as if its supreme delight would be to be permitted to wrap itself in a star-spangled banner, move across the room in three strides and a straddle, fire off two horse pistols, and die like a son of a gun, after having exercised a special penchant for divorced women, separating wives from their husbands for the sake of position, wealth, beauty, and passion. It looked as if it was troubled about stealing rain-producing theories, not for stealing, but for being caught at it. It looked as if its heart was breaking, because it had not brains enough to be a pantarch, or one-tenth part of one. It looked as if its heart would burst with envy, because other men had friends and power and applause and merit, in spite of its little, perked-up, 7x9, skull-cracked soul, poor cambric, needle-eyed soul, 1,280 trillions to the half ounce. It looked for all the world, as Tom really did the very last time he came home, just before they lay down upon their couch, in the little chamber in which was the little window, whose upper sash was down. That is to say, short, crusty, crisp, and meaner than Git, as he felt before they both lay down, and dreamed such very funny dreams. Mean, despicable, iron-hearted Tom Clark, the plague of her life, bane of her existence, and source of all her troubles. So at least it seemed to the lady in her curious vision. Presently both these figures slowly faded from her sight, and in their stead there arose through the floor a third figure, labeled Tom Clark as he may be. While she was admiring the vast superiority in all respects of this new statue, a fourth human figure entered the atelier. This figure was alive. Admirabile dictu, the woman beheld the exact counterpart of herself, clad as a working artist, a sculptor, with apron, paper cap, and dusty clothing, all complete as if she had just left chiseling the dead marble. This lemur of herself appeared deeply gratified at the appearance of the statue, for, after surveying it a while, she proceeded to arm herself with a flame-tipped baton, wherewith she touched the figure in various places, but mainly on the head, and over the region of the heart. The effect of these touches of flame was to make the figure move, and in 5 minutes the dead mass was warm with life, vitality and genius, for the phantom artiste appeared to endow the figure with a portion of her own life, and a closer inspection revealed the curious fact that the flame at the end of the staff, which was hollow, was fed from a deep well of subtle, fine, and inflammable ether in her own heart. The statue lived. It was Tom Clark, and no mistake. But heaven, what a change! What a difference between the actual and the ideal man! His features fairly blazed with the fires of genius and ambition, and they beamed like a sun, with friendship, intelligence, truth and manhood. They all held high court in his soul, and radiated from his inspired features. His very presence charged the air with mind, though his lips spoke never a word, breathed never a syllable. And now Betsy heard her alter ego speak, and it said to the living statue, "Rise, Tom Clark, rise, and be a man. Be yourself." "Rise." And it rose, stepped from the pedestal, erected its head, and such a head, while she, the phantom artiste with careful tread, and anxiously holding her nether lip between her teeth, slowly retreated backward from the room, quitting it through the door by which she had entered a little while before. She was followed majestically by the statue, which moved with power and grace, as if charged to the brim by God's galvanic batteries. End of chapter 8. Chapter 9 of Tom Clark and His Wife, The Rosicrucian Story, by P. B. Randolph. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Betsy Clark in Dreamland, Part 2. Scarcely had the two phantoms left the room than the woman on the stool, the real Betsy Clark, followed their example with a sudden bound, exclaiming as she did so, despite the warning of the hermit of the silver girdle, for whom at that moment she didn't care, not even a piece of a fig. "My husband! My husband!" Human nature, especially woman nature, could stand the pressure no longer. She felt and acted as she felt, as every woman has, since the year one, and will, until time and eternity both grow gray. "My husband!" There spake the woman. In an instant the Hermit of the Silver Girl was in a very great and unprecedented fluster. "Silly girl, didn't I tell you not to speak? Only look, see how you have gone and done it. Done me. Oh, dear, if I weren't a Rosicrucian, I'd get excessively angry. Dorgon it, if I wouldn't." And in his trouble he pronounced dog with an R. "Commend me to a female for upsetting the best calculation of the wisest Rosicrucian that ever lived. I speak from experience. I told you not to open your lips, and here you've gone and spoken right out. What's the consequence?" exclaimed the venerable Greybeard. "Why, the spell is broken. The charm fled. Nor can either be recalled before the sun has set and rose again, and once more declined toward the western sea. Familiar as I am with the secrets of Gaeli and the mysteries of magic crystals, I know that you have done very wrong, for no one is fit to consult destiny by their aid who is not competent to keep silence for an hour, no matter what the temptation or provocation to break it may be. Now hie thee homeward. Tomorrow thou mayest return again, provided thou wilt obey me, and speak not a syllable while the phantasmal game of fate is being played before thine eyes." The Hermit of the Silver Girdle had spoken truly, for at the very first moment of her lips the whole scene of enchantment vanished into thin air, leaving only a three-cornered table and a little glossy-looking ball behind. To depict her chagrin and disappointment at this abrupt termination of a very strange affair is a task totally beyond my capacities. She bounced out of the grotto in a miff, tossing her pretty head in a manner peculiarly adapted to play the very old scratch with the soft and susceptible heads and hearts of the male sect, especially their heads. But she had no idea of abandoning the venture at that point. Not she, but was fully resolved to see it out next day, even if she bit her tongue in two, in the endeavor to keep it still. Warriors, statesmen, philosophers, and well-read men can comprehend the sublimity of her resolution, because they know that of all earthly tasks, the one assigned herself was the greatest, most heroic, and one compared to which the 12 labors of the Greek god were mere child's pastime. At all events, to keep perfectly silent she would certainly try, said a voice right beside her ear. She started, attributing the circumstance to mere fancy. But again the magic word was, by unseen lips, gently, softly whispered in her ear. "Try," it said, and the word went echoing through her very soul. Whence came the voice? Who was it? What was it that spoke? Certainly not herself, nor the hermit. When was it, where was it, that ye heard that voice and word before? When, how, where had it made so deep an impression on her mind? Was it in a dream? Who can tell? She could not. My hearers, can you? Next morning, bright and early, the young girl returned once more to the grotto of the Hermit of the Silver Girdle, who dwelt on the shady borders of a forest wild. An hour or two elapsed in friendly converse and admonition, and now again behold the dissimilar twain once more seated silently before the little table, on which glittered, as before, the rare, pearl-disked, magic, wonder-working crystal globe. Again, as before, the glorious play of colors came and went. Again it faded, and she saw the atelier, the artiste, and the artiste's living statue. But this time Betsy could look right through its body, as if it were made of finely polished glass. Tom Clark stood before her. She saw and comprehended him on all sides, soul, spirit, body. And though she was neither a strong-minded woman, a lecturess on philosophy, the good time coming, nor woman's sacred and delicate work, and though she knew but little of the human organism, beyond a few familiar commonplaces, Yet she comprehended enough of the glorious mystery before her to be aware that the red, pulsing lump just beneath its throat was technically known and considered as the heart, and she couldn't help admiring its wonderful and mighty mechanism, its curious movements, mystical arrangements of parts, and adaptation of means to ends. Its auricles, valves, and veins, its ventricles, and its pump, tapping the well of life, and forcing its water through a million yards of hose, plentifully irrigating the loftiest gardens of man's body, and hence, of his imperishable soul. The inspection was almost too much for the girl, who had liked to have screamed out her wonderment and delight, but having made up her mind to keep still this time, she, by dint of much handkerchief and tongue-biting, succeeded, to the external credit of herself, or any other woman. "That which you see," said the hermit, who of course had the privilege of talking as he pleased, "is a man's heart in full play. It is, as you perceive, filled with blood, whose office is to give life to the body and vigor to the mind. But the heart has other chambers than those containing the venous and arterial fluids, for all its valves and valves contain innumerable small cells, and these cells secrete and contain certain aeriform fluids far more potential than blood, and which subserve the ends of a higher and far more wonderful economy. There are two kinds of blood. So also are there two kinds of the subtle fluid I have mentioned. One sort is born with us, and we come into the world with exactly one half of these cells full, while the other half are entirely empty, and so they must remain until they are filled from the heart of someone else. Males are born with the cells of the left side empty, females with those of the right unfilled, while the other cells of each are always full. These fluids are real, actual, perceptible, but imponderable. Their name is love, and when things take their proper and natural course, the fluid flows out from the cells of a woman's heart into the empty ones of a man's, and the full cells of a man's heart fill the empty ones of a woman's, in which case they are said to love each other. Two men cannot thus love, nor can two females. Many of either sex travel from the cradle to the grave without either filling, or being filled in turn. For it is a law that love cannot flow unless it be tapped by the opposite party, and it can only be tapped by kindness, gentleness, respect, these three. The unloved and unloving are only half men and half women, and believe me, my child, there is a mighty sight of halfness in this world of ours. Much of it comes of not trying to have it otherwise. People, married people especially, devote half their days to growling because they have not got somebody else's wife or husband, when the fact is that their own partners are quite good enough, as they would find out with little proper endeavor. Men expect a woman's love to bubble up all the time. Fools! Why don't they sound its depth and bring it to the surface? There are, altogether, too many divorces. A divorce first, and the next step, is dangerous. I knew a wife of three divorces. I knew a man the husband of two consecutive divorcees. Good intentions? Bah! Hell is paved with such. I know of 50 broken-hearted women whose husbands, after wearing them out, sneaked off to Indiana and robbed them of name, fame, life, and hope. The demons! Out upon the wretches! The woman who has wasted her youth and bloom upon a man who then wants a divorce, and permits him to obtain it, is a fool. He promised for life. Make him keep it, even if you invoke the law's strong arm. If both agree, that alters the case. I have a legal acquaintance in New York who drives a large trade in the divorce line, at $25 a head. I feel called upon to expose the infernal methods by means of which it is done, and I call upon the legislature to see to it that the thing is not suffered to go on. A is a lawyer. B and C are husband and wife. B wants a divorce without publicity, goes to A, and pays a fee to secure it, but has no legal quibble by means of which to obtain it. A gives him the following counsel. Go to a brothel, take up with an inmate thereof, call her D. Make 3 or 4 male and female acquaintances, E, F, G, and H. Introduce them to D as your wife. Leave town a day or two, but take care that D is well watched in the interim. Of course, you will avail herself of your absence to ply her vocation. E, F, G, and H furnish the most incontestable and damning proof of her supposed guilt. The witnesses may or may not know your precious scheme. You prosecute the lemon under your wife's name. She, of course, knowing nothing about the proceedings, poor thing. The court takes the evidence, hands it over to a referee, who passes on it, returns it, affirmed, to the court, which forthwith enters a decree of perpetual divorce. A scoundrel goes unwhipped of justice, and an honest woman's reputation is forever damned. Legislators, I tell you that these things are done every day. I was told it, could not believe it, and assuming to be desirous of such a decree, received the above counsel, word for word, from a practitioner at the New York bar. Legislators, here is a crime worse than murder. Will you sanction it longer? How prevent it? Summon the witnesses and performer of this marriage, or at least prove the identity of the woman or the man, as the case may be, for women practice in that court also. There would be far less of this sort of iniquity if there were fewer blatant philosophy mongers afloat on the tide of the times, inculcating their morbid, detestable, blasphemous, brothel-filling, harmonial theories, all of which directly pander to the worst vice a man can have, meanness. People insanely look for and expect perfection in others, not only without the slightest claim thereto themselves, but without the least attempt in that direction, which is a very suicidal policy to pursue. Such soon come to be vampires, consuming themselves and destroying others, raving tigers at their own fold's side. Sometimes one person's affection, which is akin to love, goes out toward and clings around another. But death ever flaps its wings by the side of such, when that other fails to give it back. The unloving loved one, if such a thing be possible, is a born thief, from the cradle to the clouds, and there are a great many such robbers in the world. But how is one to love when one don't feel like it, or has attractions in another direction? Asked Betsy. Where duty and honor point, there should the attraction lie. Whosoever shall render themselves lovable and lovely can no more help being loved than smoke can help ascending through the air. Make yourself agreeable to the partner of your lot in life, and that partner can no more help loving you than mirrors can help reflecting. The heart of yonder statue, which is that of the man who is destined to be a future husband of yours, said the old man, pointing to the first figure of the previous day, which had, together with the second, reappeared upon the scene, will be only half full by reason of your withholding and refusing all tender wifeliness. You will rob him and yourself of the better meat of life. Your years will be gloomy ones. You will make him wretched, and be the same yourself. Cheat your bodies of health, your souls of happiness and vigor. Take heed, correct the fault. You can't? There is no such word. Try. Turning now to the second figure of the previous day, he observed, See, Tom Clark's heart is empty. All its cells are filled with a void, hollow as the apples of Persia's arid wastes. Have mercy, heaven, on him whose heart throbs not with the rapturous burden of a woman's love. Pity him whose soul groweth not tender with the love-light beaming from thy baby's eyes. Ah, What a world of nameless glory flashes from an infant's eyes! They are telescopes through which my soul sees heaven, through which I watch the mazy dance of starry worlds, and behold the joys of seraphim. We Rosicrucians love babies, seed of the ages, and their mothers too, because they are such. For we believe that after death the maids fare worst, the wives fare better, but no tongue or pen can express the rapture that awaits those who have borne sons and daughters to the world and heaven. Bachelors, bah! I will pass by such cattle, merely remarking that their place is not to be found in heaven, or the other place. They repair in a body to Fiddler's Green, and ought to stay there, if they do not. And Betsy gazed on the forlorn figure of poor Tom, who was all one-sided, crooked, lean. His hopes and joys were flown, because no one loved him, not even his wife. And who else should, if not she? And so he was wretched, like full many another whom I have seen as I journeyed down life's glades. His soul was driven back upon, and forced to eat itself, day by day, and year after year. And this great wrong you will do, said the hermit, and this great wrong I have already done, thought the girl, wife, widow, wife, four in one, with that strange, anomalous inconsistency peculiar to dream life. I have done badly, but this I will do no more, not another second longer. Bravely, royally thought, and said, better, if more gloriously done, and that is just the difference, saying and doing. The first is common, the last is very rare. Better still, if truly said, and still more nobly done, was whispered in the woman's ear in the same low, silvery voice she had heard the day before. Who was it that spoke these melodious words? Not the hermit in gray. It was the invisible Hesperina, telegraphing Betsy's soul across the vast expanse of the continent of dream? Who shall answer me these questions? Said the silver-girdled hermit, as he smiled a smile of more than human gladness, more than human meaning, it is well. She looked again toward the magic globe, and lo, within a moment its disk had changed. The first two figures had disappeared. The third had once more come upon the scene, a conspicuous actor in such a terrific drama, as neither earth nor starry eyes ever saw before, may they never see again. The Gorgon, War, had glutted himself on Europe's bloody fields, and had flown across the salt sea, alighting on our shores. The demon landed with a howl, midway between Moultrie and Sumter. He had seized the reins of government, proclaimed himself sole lord and king, strangled reason in his dreadful gripe, until she lay bleeding on the gory earth, and meek-eyed peace fled tearfully away from his grim presence, and hid herself upon a distant mountain-top, whence she could survey the shock of armies on the plains beneath, and sigh, and long for liberty and rule. War and carnage, side by side, with gory banners flying, marched from one end of the nation to the other, until their footsteps rested on the graves of 800,000 men. God's precious word was disregarded, and his blessed soil dyed red with human blood, the rich, fat blood of the noblest race that ever trod his earth, the blood of your brother and of mine, O my countrymen! And now the loud-lunged trumpets brayed their fierce alarums, and summoned Columbia's sons to deeds at which our grandsons shall turn pale, deeds of heroic daring such as Greece, nor Rome, nor Carthage ever dreamed of, nor storied page has chronicled. Summoned them to Sumter's stony ramparts, and Potomac's grassy banks. Summoned them to do, and die. 800,000 men! And they went, going as tornadoes go, to strike for a nation's life, to strike the foul usurper low, and fling his carcass to the dogs. They would have struck hard and home, but they were stayed. That was not the little game of generals and statesmen, and of high contracting parties. Oh, no, victory would never do. Let us fight the foe with gloves on, said the minister. They fought. The foe wore gloves also, but the palms were brass, the fingers iron, and the knuckles polished steel. But the minister had his whim, and unborn generations will feel its consequences. 800,000 graves. And the Union legions went, from decreed fate toward a consummated destiny, in spite of ministers, their minions, or the little game. And Tom Clark went too. And loud the trumpets brayed, and the heavy drums did sound, and they woke strange and fearful energies in the slumbering nation's heart. What a magic transmutation! Plowmen transformed to heroes, such as shall forever put Cincinnatus in the shade. Day laborers, carriers of the hod, claiming, and rightfully too, high places in the pantheon of heroic demigods. Look at Fredericksburg. Forget not the Black Brigade. Bear in mind the deeds of 100 regiments on 100 fields. Fields, too, that might and would have finally decided the carnage and the quarrel, but for the minister, his gloves, his little game, his great whim, and lo, its consequences. Tom Clark quickened into life by the subtle, flame-tipped staff in the hands of the phantom artiste, the proprietress of the wonderful atelier and man-factory, now stepped forth through the door of the room, and forthwith the scene expanded to such vast dimensions that Betsy found it impossible to realize the magic mimicry, for the whole thing was too real, and on too grand a scale. She stood on the hill of the world, surveying its valleys at leisure. Tom Clark apparently heard, deeply heard, his country's wail of agony, for unchecked treason was then gripping her tightly by the throat. That cry called him to a field of glory, such as God's green earth never before afforded, nor his sun ever saw, nor his moon, nor his myriad, twinkling, starry eyes. Clark's soul was in arms, as his offended ears drank in the hoarse, deep thunders of treason's cannonry, pouring iron hail upon a prostrate nation's head, and his eyes beheld the flashing of the guns, as they vomited a hell of iron and fire upon Sumter, upon Anderson, and the peerless 83. Tom Clark saw the storm, and his heart indignant swelled at the insult to the starred gem flag of human rights and liberty. An insult, long since wiped out in traitor's blood, but for the minister, and the gloves, and the little game, and the whim, whose consequences are 800,000 skeletons. Like a true man, Clark, inspired by a true woman, the phantom wife and artiste, ran, leapt, flew to arms and deathless glory. Ah, God, to arms and fadeless glory! He had no time to grieve or grumble or to criticize this general or that battle. He looked over the heads of cowards and traitors in his own camp, at the noble men in arms, and who bravely fought and nobly died for the country. He saw and gloriously emulated such men as Lyon, Saxton, Hunter, Fremont, and Baker. Baker, O Oregon, my tears fall with thine, for him. He was mine, yours, ours. Ours in his life, in his nobleness, in his soul-arousing eloquence, in the valor and the effulgent glory of his death, the result of another whim, and lo, the consequences. And now, see, behold the smoke of yonder battle. Death rides on cannon balls today, and tonight there will be much mourning in the land, for strong men in thousands are giving up the ghost. Weep not, O widow, for God accepts such sacrifices. Mourn not, O orphans, he who tempers the wind to the shorn lamb will hold thee in his keeping. Thy grateful country will not let thee want for bread, and by it will be a proud boast of thine. My father died to redeem the land from treason. Death rides on cannon balls today, in the fight that we are seeing. Tom Clark is a hero. See, he leads the van. God spare him. What a presence! What blows he deals for liberty and the Union! Lo, the thundering battalions of the brave and bold, but insane, misguided, and revengeful foe, sweep down the embattled plain, their war cry ringing out above the belching roar of artillery. And with such might and valor do they charge, that freedom's cohorts reel and stagger beneath the dreadful shock of arms. Another such a charge, and all is lost. But see, there comes a man from the ranks, a common soldier. His voice rings clearly out upon the sulfur-laden air. Follow me! The inspiring words and actions kindle new fire in the wavering breasts of hundreds. They rise. They throw themselves upon the foe. They hush his battle cry in death. He is repulsed. Who did that? Demands an aide-de-camp. Private Thomas W. is the response. Hero, greet him in my name, as color sergeant, says the general, and Tom Clark is promoted on the field. The first day's fight is over. It is renewed next day, and when the tired guns give over with the sun, a group of soldiers are gathered round a man. Who is it? Who is it? I thought you knew. Why, it is the man who saved the 10th Brigade, and was rewarded on the spot, Captain Thomas W. With the sunrise came the foe. Pass the word along the line. There, Captain Clark is wanted at the tent of the general in command. He goes. Captain Clark, do you see yonder battery of the enemy? It must be taken, or we are lost. If I give you command of a regiment whose colonel was killed yesterday, can you take it? I will try. General, the battery on the left is ours, says an aide-de-camp an hour afterwards. It is taken, and all its men are either dead or prisoners. Indeed, so soon? Greet the commander in my name, and salute him as Colonel Thomas W. Another day dawns on the ensanguined field, a field where privates were heroes and generals poltroons. Hard fighting is before us. Up, up the soldiers spring, and on to death, or victory they rush. Oh, it was a splendid sight, those death-defying demigods, who, had they in previous battles had but a man to lead them, would have taken 50 rebel strongholds in as many hours. But such was not the drift of the pretty little game. More men must die, more ditches must be dug, and more human bones must fill them, else how can ministers carry out their whims? How else can the enemy be fought and placated at the same time? It isn't constitutional, besides which it hurts the prospect for the presidency of the reunited States, which prospect would be forever marred, and the little game played out, if we fought without gloves, and violated our constitutional obligations by kicking the wind out of the foe, who is trying might and main to strangle the nation. He might hereafter say, "You, sir, fought without gloves on," which wouldn't do, you know. Damn that Colonel Thomas W. If the fellow keeps on at that rate, we'll surely whip somebody badly. Curse the fellow. He don't believe in the glove business or in the erring sister's theory, soliloquized somebody on a certain day. This'll never do. Aide, come here. Go tell Colonel Clark take possession of the valley down yonder, and hold it at all hazards till nightfall. But, General, he has only 700 men. The foe is 13,000 strong. So much the worse for, he meant Clark, but said, the enemy. They will fight like tigers. And the aide transmitted the order, shaking hands with the colonel as he rode away, muttering, "Poor fellow, his goose is cooked for a certainty. What a pity he stands in somebody's light, somebody who is jealous of even a private's fame. Ah, me! And he rode back to headquarters, wondering whose turn next it would be to face the forlorn hope, such a singular number of which this rebellion has developed. But there was no flinch in Colonel Thomas W., no flinch in his men. They all saw the hazard, but they were men and soldiers. They knew how to obey orders when their superiors did not. But then again, they had no hopes of success in a general election. They had no little game. Theirs is not to reason why. Theirs is but to do or die, and they done it. On, on, like more than Spartan heroes, on they dashed, literally, as absolutely as anything earthly can be, into the jaws of death, into the mouth of hell. I have a mini bullet on my table that plowed a furrow through a brother's heart of mine in that same dreadful valley. Away they went, that gallant band, that gallant man, and many a bullet went crashing through skulls and bones as they went, and many a soul sped its way to God ere the cohort reached the knoll in the valley. Once there, they were no longer men. They were as sublime exemplar gods. But a man fell before the resistless force of 100 horses charging with all of treason's vehement strength, and the gallant man went down, and the thunder of iron hoofs exploded in his ear, and then the cloud passed on. And Thomas Clark went down, as truth and justice and I went down. But he rose again, so ever does truth and justice. And as for me, Gene de Messandres, let those beware by whom I fell. Down to the gory soil he went, but even while the woman sat there in the grotto, gazing till her eyeballs fairly ached with intensity, sat gazing with suppressed breath, so still was she, sat gazing, her blood on fire, her pulse beating 300 to the minute, beating with a deep, fierce, tumultuous fire, sat gazing stilly, while her heart bounded and thumped within its bony citadel as if impatient of its duress, and longing to burst its tabernacle, and let the imprisoned soul go free. Sat gazing, while her eyes, large gray eyes, all the while gleamed with a light that proved her capable of giving birth to heroes, even while thus she gazed on the wheeling squadrons, the charging hosts, and the great guns, as they gave forth their fiery vomit, charged with sudden deaths. The man, Tom Clark, sprung to his feet again, and, as he staunched his blood with one hand, he pointed with the other at the foe. "Follow me," he cried. "See, we are reinforced. On to victory, on!" And his voice rose above the tempest, and it flew over the spaces, and it fell upon the ears of a great man, and the great man wrung his hands, and he thought, "Not dead yet. Damn the fellow, he will make us win a victory, and that'll never do. Dear me, that cursed fool will spoil my little game. Oh, for night, or a fresh division of the enemy. I must reinforce him, though, else it'll get into that infernal Tribune, or into that cursed George Wilkes paper, and that'll spoil my little game. Oh, there, aid, go tell General Truman to reinforce Colonel Thomas W. My little game," and he arranged his epaulets and gave his mustache an additional killing twist. In the meantime, Tom Clark had charged the enemy with bayonets with the remnant of his own force, followed by hundreds whom his example had transformed into something more sublime than fighting soldiers. And now occurred one of those conflicts which make or mar the fortunes of a nation, one of those terrible multi-personal combats which mark a century's history and strike the ages dumb with awe. One of those terrific scenes in the world's great drama that mark historic epochs and enshrine men's names in fiery letters upon the scrolls of fame. The charge and the action were short, sharp, swift, desperate, but at its close the flag of the planet Gems, with sapphire circle diadems, floated proudly over the scene of treason's battle lost, a nation's battle won. Day closes again, and the wounded hero in an ambulance was born fainting, almost dying from the field. "Colonel Clark, can I do anything for you?" said one of the fighting generals to the stricken man. A bullet had gone through him. "You are a noble fellow, and I speak for myself, your comrades in arms, and for our country. Can I, can they, can we, can she do anything for you in this sad hour of your destiny? If so, I beg you to speak." "Alas, no, my friend," replied he, reviving only to swoon again. A little cold water on his temples partially dissipated the coma, but not all the fog from his perceptions, for his general's words, "Can she," considerably obfuscated his intellect, and he thought, "He means Betsy. That's the only she I know of." And then he strengthened up for a last dying effort, strove to collect his thoughts, partly succeeded, and said, "Nothing more, dear general?" "Yes, no. I'm dying, going home. Tell Betsy, dear Betsy, I did not find her out till it was too late. Tell her that I loved her from my soul at last. Tell her that. She can't stand the pressure any longer, globe or no globe, hermit or no hermit, not another minute." "You bet. It's a pretty howdy-do. Me a-sittin' here, and poor Tom layin' there, killed a'most to death," shrieked the fair girl in the grotto of the hermit of the silver girdle, waked up beyond endurance by the skillful magic of the weird recluse. And repeating the Californian, "You bet," with vehement emphasis on the last word, she sprung to her feet, in spite of the warnings of the man who dealt in magic crystal globes in the precincts of a forest wild, upsetting table, tripod, stool and hermit, in her eagerness to reach Tom's side and give him wifely ministry. What luck she might have had in bridging Phantom River, I know not, having omitted to remain long enough for inquiry, not having had time to thus devote. But this I do know, namely that she nearly kicked the veritable Mr. Thomas W. Clark completely out of bed, the bed at whose foot was a window, whose upper sash was down, the identical window through which came all the funny things of this most veracious history, which, of course, is all true. Betsy woke from excitement, Tom from being kicked, and both had finished their double dreams. "What in the thunder's up now, Bet? No, Lizzie, I mean," said he, checking the less respectful utterance, and modulating his voice to what he doubtless intended to be a velvet dulcet cadence, but which wouldn't pass for that in an Italian opera. "Not nothing, Tommy dear. Not nothing, Lizzie. Not nothing. That ain't grammar, sweet. I was paragorically speaking, my turkle dove. Only I've been having two very funny dreams."
"You, two dreams? That is queer."
"You bet.
What about, Lizzie?"
"Oh, all about how we didn't love each other as we ought to, husband. And dorg on my buttons, wife, if I haven't had just two such dreams myself, all about a precipice and a pile. Oh, it wasn't a pile, though."
"You bet, and my dreams were all about how I ought to love you, and didn't, and then again I did."
"That's a dear."
"You bet. Let's love each other this time out, will you?"
"I will you?"
"You bet. Let's profit by our dreams."
"I mean to. Won't you?"
I'll try.
"We'll both try."
"You bet."
And they tried to forgive and forget.
"Will you do the same?" asked the Rosicrucian of the angular character, who had told his own story in disguise. The latter saw that his secret was out, yet his heart was touched, for as a great teardrop rolled down his cheek, he said, with smothered breath, the holy words, "I'll try," Amen, said the Rosicrucian. Amen, said we all. And then, turning to his auditors again, the storyteller said, Friends, go thou and do likewise, and so long as you live, I charge you never forget the Rosicrucian nor his story, nor it, the shadow, nor Hesperina, the light, nor Atenithi, the genius of the hour, nor the silver-girdled hermit, and his crystal globe in a forest wild, nor, above all, the little window at the foot of the bed, whose upper sash was down. A day or two afterwards we reached Panama, and after that we saw but little of our entertainer. But before I finally lost sight of him, he told me that he was about writing some Rosicrucian stories, the manuscript of which he would send me when ready. I have received some, and they will be published by me as soon as I can spare the time to attend to it, which will be, When This Cruel War Is Over, PBR, Utica, November, 1863. End of Chapter 9. End of Tom Clark and His Wife, The Rosicrucian Story, by P. B. Randolph.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.